So I'd like to start by saying that I think the terms science and global would sit quite uncomfortably with the majority of historians and sociologists of science, and perhaps less so with some philosophers of science. It has been a particular ambition and claim of the sciences that their methods and experiments can, in theory, work anywhere and at any time. It has been the task of many historians of science since the 1980s to revise this claim, however, to show how the cultural and geographic contingencies through which scientific ideas and practices are formed always rely on more than the replication of codified procedures to make them work. The relationship between global claims and local practices are, we're taught, intermediated by people and instruments who have to be moved to make science work. That said, there have been some models that have sought to account for the emergence and movement of science in relationship to the globe. Perhaps the most notorious is George Posada's three-stage model of the globalization of Western science, where science stood as a byword for truth, rationality, order, and civilization. And this model has, of course, received numerous critiques, most notably by Kapil Raj in his Relocating Modern Science, which I think has done much to demonstrate that the place where knowledge practices called science was done in the 18th and 19th centuries were generally not, or not absolutely, in Western Europe. But as I see it, the main driving force behind a global approach to history today has been from economic historians, generally in the last 30 years. Describing an attempt to get away from ideas of the nation state, a dominant idea of the global has meant a particular kind of history of connectedness or integration, which is typically focused on the movements of commodities. Apologies, very sketchy kind of map. This approach, Corbett's leading practitioner's commodity chain theory, has resulted in maps such as this, where pointy lines represent both the movements of commodities and a resulting integration or coming together of places around the world to form what they claim the global interaction. While I think this pointy arrow approach to global history is not absolutely dispensable, I believe it shouldn't serve as a guide to what a global history of science might look like. A first problem is the total flattening out of space that is represented in these accounts, particularly ocean space, where water serves as a backdrop to emphasize simply how far commodities seem to have traveled. The main implication of this approach is that movement of commodities is unproblematic. Commodities, it seems to claim, are solid and inherently stable, and that the role of cultural organization in general, and labor in particular, are simply lubricants to the successful flow of these commodities. This is particularly problematic if we consider what it means to ignore the problems always faced by merchants to get things to move uninterrupted across water. The flattening out of space in this way is indicative of what Philip Steinberg has characterized as the representation of non-territorialized ocean that went hand in hand in the 19th century with the needs of industrial capitalism to preserve freedom of mobility. It also reminds me of the problems Marshall Sahlins has warned us against that have been enacted by proponents of world systems theory. These proponents, Sahlins argues, theorize the structures that make up Western capitalist expansion as total and uncompromising, with the effect of juggernauting through local cultural systems and thus removing any potential agency to resist or remold the meaning of exchange between European and non-European interactions. While world systems theories are not champions of globalized capitalism, Sahlins says that by endowing it with such concrete and totalizing force, it does the work of capitalism and Western empire for it. The same could well be said for pointy-arrowed integrated global histories. The role of science and technology in commodity chain models of global history has largely been to provide explanatory reasons for the efficient, secure, and ordered movement of commodities across land and mostly seas by ship. For this, two maritime revolutions are frequently evoked: the first in time and navigation, and the second in steam. The revolution in navigation and time refers to the development of means of finding longitude at sea, typically associated with famous European voyages of discovery to the Pacific. In these accounts, the symbols of ingeniously made timekeepers, such as this, and the advances of expeditionary astronomy serve as allegories for a totally imagined European order and uncontested dominance. This homogenizing image of the globe and European movement in commodity chain theory should be contrasted with practices undertaken by groups of typically invisible Europeans on voyages, who are not necessarily always willing to work in accordance with the unidirectional flow of commodities that pointy arrows usher in, but on whose labor the movement of goods and peoples typically relied, that is, the ordinary maritime workers and sailors. Right through the 18th and 19th centuries, a practice undertaken by European sailors powering ships into the southern hemisphere was a ceremony typically referred to as crossing the line, which marked the passing of a ship over the equator. Sailors who had previously crossed the line sought to conduct this ceremony over those sailors who were passing into the southern hemisphere for the first time. The ceremony usually involved the character of Neptune coming over the stern and quarterdeck in procession with his court. As Greg Denning has described, and I quote, "Neptune would perform some farcical charade of the officer's navigational tasks and declared that the ship had infringed on his domain. A mock trial of those guilty of the infringement would then begin. The trial was full of insults, injustices, erotic oaths, and compromising choices. A novice, for example, would have to choose between shouting, 'God save the king!' and getting shaving cream shoved down his throat when he opened his mouth." End quote. This was usually followed by being forced to hang in a ducking stool for as many times as could be bared before paying a ransom to stop the initiation. The view of officers and of polite, rational European society in the late 18th century was often incredibly hostile to the idea of crossing the line ceremonies. Diderot, in his entry for the Baptism of the Tropics, in his Encyclopedia, described the practice as an abhorrent and ridiculous ceremony. Captain Bligh of the infamous mutiny that occurred in April 1789 described it as inhuman and brutal. But there was important meaning behind the ritual, marking as it did not just the movement between northern and southern hemispheres, but also the brutal forms of naval discipline and coercion inflicted upon this labour force to get ships near the equator. It also served to symbolise to the officers, as it should to us, the role of collective memory among social groups representing the typically invisible labourers upon whom the movement of commodities relied, marking rank not by admiralty-imposed structures, but by experience of an event taken to be abhorrent by their masters. Memory in this sense also means imagining. The line crossed by European vessels was important because it meant anticipating and crossing into a future time and place in which the meanings of the European world could be undone. The idea that movement can also mean imagining a different order of things is something we lose entirely if we stick to the commodity chain model of global interaction and cohesion currently on offer. In their work on the global coffee trade, Stephen Topic and William Clarence Smith say that they take as the inspiration for their commodity chain approach the theory of man, production, and exchange offered in a paragraph by Karl Marx in the German ideology. If we were to take seriously the role of labour and the transformative potential of movement, then I think we might respond with another of Marx. Global historians, you have nothing to lose but your commodity chains. You have a world to win. One way of opening up potential worlds is surely to pay attention to moments of rupture and tension as much as connectedness. Rupture can, of course, occur in the form of mutiny as pictured on the slide. In this event, in April 1789, the captain, William Bligh, was forced by a large number of the ship's crew into a small cutter, 1,000 miles west of Tahiti, in which the following exchange of items was claimed by Bligh to have taken place. The boatsmen and seamen who were to go into the boat were allowed to collect twine, canvas, lines, sails, cordage, an 8-20-gallon cask of water, and Mr. Samuel also got a quadrant and compass, but was forbidden, on pain of death, to touch either map, ephemeris, book of astronomical observations, sextant, timekeeper, or any of my surveys or drawings. Mr. Samuel attempted to save the timekeeper and a box of my surveys when he was hurried away with, "Damn your eyes, you're well off to get what you have." Following the insurrection, the mutineers and their cargo of surveys, sextant, and timekeeper did what from a global perspective meant going off grid, locating an island uncharted by Europeans and burning their ship. The mutiny on the Bounty was not an exceptional incident. In fact, sailors and maritime workers in the 18th and 19th centuries routinely contested the many injustices over absent remuneration and extreme forms of extortion. As Marcus Redeker and Peter Linnebarth reminded us, the origin of the term strike comes from the Act in 1768 of insurrectory British sailors cutting ship sails to prevent the vessels from leaving port. But the kind of tensions and ruptures that underlay European practices in the Pacific were not always marked by breaks as distinct as mutiny. One way to uncover these, I think, is to pay attention to the particular resources that have been used to explain global practice, and to test how much what people assume now to be uncontestable global practice in fact represent global ambition by particular interests. The story of the British quest for longitude is one example. Longitude is represented by the vertical lines running down maps and charts. These lines are used to designate the east-west position of a point on the Earth's surface and measured in degrees in relation to a central line of longitude. Finding the longitude at sea in the 18th century was regarded as a problem for several European states, including the British. One result was that in 1714 in England, an Act of Parliament was passed to establish a Board of Longitude to facilitate attempts to devise a solution for finding longitude at sea. As stated earlier, central to accounts seeking to explain British presence in the Pacific has been a concern with the navigational and cartographical capabilities of Europeans. Particular explanatory power has been laid on hardware such as marine timekeepers. One of which is shown on the slide. Which have stood for the uncompromising success of British technological and scientific ingenuity and its ability to overcome the problems of long-distance travel and trade. But such triumphalist stories linking scientific ambition and its instruments constructed in the metropole to accounts of global practice are simply not convincing. A persistent claim why longitude matter for sailors is that without it, they were especially subject to being shipwrecked. Without the hardware, sailors could not know where they were. But as the historian Andrew Cook has pointed out, longitude matters for East India Company captains not primarily to prevent shipwrecks, but rather to ensure that officers knew when to turn north from a particular easterly point after rounding the Cape of Good Hope. This was in order to catch the monsoon season to carry them northwards. With no land and little else to help coordinate direction, knowing one's longitude was thought to be essential at a few key moments so that ships would not miss the winds they relied on to carry them northwards. By missing the winds, ships could be delayed from returning to Britain with their expensive cargo, which could result in a massive commercial loss for the backers of the East India Company. Yet the task of getting methods of finding longitude onto ships that could simply work in the first place was itself an incredibly contested and unsteady task. For a start, it was not clear which timekeepers to trust to be put on board ships. On land, in the late 18th century, routine astronomical procedures were beginning to be introduced to test the going of timekeepers, to see if they might be suitable being put on a ship. The results of these trials were rarely, if ever, accepted by the clock and watchmaking community as authoritative. Late 18th century London witnessed artisans contesting with what they saw as an infringement by astronomers and members of the philosophical community upon the control and assessment of their skill. This period also saw artisans competing against each other, as the Board of Longitude moved to get artisans to compete, to offer the best models and explanations with the aim of standardising and mass-producing timekeepers. So the following quote is one of the politest statements made by a particularly rambunctious clockmaker called Thomas Earnshaw, concerned what he saw as the attempts by the group to assess the worth of his machines. "A best repeating pocket timekeeper, made in the manner they now are, would astonish the world, and almost petrify with wonder. If it were possible that by taking one to pieces, they could be made sensible of the nicety of its workmanship and mechanism. But alas, no one but a watchmaker can possibly be acquainted with this extraordinary piece of mechanical art." Unfortunately for Earnshaw, for timekeepers to enter the social life of a ship on its way to the Pacific, they would have to be acquainted by many different people who were not watchmakers. Anticipating the potential danger of damage or theft to such wondrous and fragile objects, on Captain Cook's second voyage of discovery in 1772, three timekeepers were sent out by the Board of Longitude, along with the following instructions. "Resolved, that such boxes, as the clockmakers Messrs. Kendall and Arnold shall judge most proper for the reception of their respective watch machines, be immediately provided. That three good locks be also provided and affixed to each box. That one of the locks of each box be kept by the commander of the sloop wherein such box may be. That the key of another of the said locks be kept by the first lieutenant of the said sloop, and that the key of the third lock be kept by such one of the above-mentioned observers as shall be on board." Locks and keys had a very definite meaning in late 18th century England. As discussed by Peter Linnabaugh in his brilliant London Hanged, locks and keys were an absolutely essential part of the logic of capitalism that had begun with the extensive system of enclosure that was being accelerated in the 18th century, and which moved from the extension of private ownership of houses through to being embodied in very personal items like bureaus and jewellery boxes. Accompanying the system of enclosure by locks and keys was a system of terrific state violence against even minor infringements on property. We might say, to attempt to manage the use of timekeepers on board ships, the state had to resort to familiar and particular forms of violence which characterised the struggle for power on land. However, sticking to the prescribed ritual of locks and keys for these potential fragile timekeepers was itself very difficult. For a start, for a timekeeper's rate to be known, it had to be taken on land. Timekeepers on voyages on discovery were routinely accompanied by a Greenwich-trained astronomer, sent also to deploy a range of other instruments and techniques for measuring and testing longitude. Managing the timekeepers was a very difficult process that demanded enormous amounts of labour. This labour consisted of two forms. The first from astronomers themselves, who wrote in detail about the problems they encountered moving timekeepers on shore and manipulating them alongside the other astronomical equipment and instrumentation. On the 15th of November 1772, William Wales, one of the astronomers on Captain Cook's second voyage, wrote that Captain Cook ordered us to have everything on board the ship on the 16th in the morning. Therefore, in the evening, we took down the clocks and instruments, and in the morning packed them up and carried them down to the wharf, where boats met us and fetched them off. I sat in the stern sheets of the boat, with one watch on either side of me and a hand on each of them to keep them steady. And both were going after we put off from the shore. In laying the boat alongside, the coxswain let her strike, but not so hard as to give me the least apprehension at the time. But when I got on board, I found Mr. Arnold's watch had stopped, for which I can assign no reason if it was not caused by the boat striking the ship. The second form of labour was the crucial role that was acquired from personnel acting as workmen in carrying out constant maintenance and repairs on clocks. In his logbook on May 18, 1773, Wales wrote the following. I must not quit this place without mentioning a circumstance which happened while we were here. On the 29th of May, when we came to wind up the watches, it was found that the middle lock of Mr. Arnold's was damaged and could not be opened. I suppose by its being opened with the wrong key the day before. But the person, Mr. Pickensgill, who attended then for Mr. Cooper, he being away, it was proposed to open the box by sawing off the staples into which the bolts of the lock shoot. But I objected to this method, being apprehensive that the action of the saw might shake the watch too much, and proposed to have it opened by wrenching out the screws which fasten those staples to cover the box. Which was accordingly done by introducing the blade of a turn saw between the box and cover, and turning it round, and it did not disturb the watch in the least. There were present Captain Furneaux, Mr. Cooper, Mr. Forsters, and several others. As some damage was done to the lock, it was taken off to be mended, and the watch trusted under the other two until it was done. Our armour not happening to be ingenious enough, we were obliged to send it on board the Adventure, from whence we did not get it until the 3rd of June, when I put it on again and Mr. Cooper locked it as usual. Timekeepers were not stable objects on voyages that simply facilitated ships to go where they needed. Rather, timekeepers entered into and themselves added to an unstable environment that relied on the constant overcoming and renegotiating physical pressures and social and political interests to result in something like a nice pointy line as seen on the first slide. This renegotiation rarely resembled the forms of polite and rational argumentation of harbour mastering political public spheres, as sometimes imagined by historians. Rather, it continually relied on forms of labour and ways of being that always displayed the resources and potential to think away from the interests of power, but which were routinely coupled with disciplining techniques to try to replicate something like order. And it is around the point of competing interests that I think gets to the point of what a history of the global in relation to science should mean. Thinking about global approaches to history and to the history of science is necessary for us to do because it is already being done. It is being done by professional historians as well as advocates of policy that celebrate a particular image of a global world. The danger is that this interest typically privileges and naturalises the ambitions of power. A global approach to the sciences, as I reckon, has real potential to go against this privileging of power. By going against the grain of narratives that have typically sought a legitimising potential by appropriating science and technology, the constant forms of struggle and negotiation made by marginalised and invisible groups is definitely possible. In this, I'm certainly following what Richard Drayton has described as the need by historians dealing with imperial and world history to think about the past through their own present first. To write a world history, Drayton has warned us against forms of imperial world history that have passively and actively collaborated with forms of imperial domination. This post-patriotic approach means to strive to say those things we find uncomfortable to say in the contemporary moment. And to quote directly, it is in the striving against one's inner grain that the scholar acquires a capacity to help his or her own community renegotiate its sensibilities, and in particular to lower the frontier between the self and the foreign. In terms of the global, I hope to have made clear, we do not have the first move. Global history and global histories of science does not, just by virtue of being global, mean that different forms of history will necessarily be told. Importantly, it runs the risk of merely capitulating forms of imperial and hegemonic power and writing out exactly those groups we have every need to reimagine. The virtues of a global approach surely must lie in our ability to think past and uncover from the so-called globalizing forces all those forms of agency and struggle that existed and still exist despite the apparent functioning through time of global movement. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your paper, Owen. So before I make some comments about the paper that's just been presented, I want to first congratulate James Poskett and his team for putting together this exciting series of events here at CRASH on global science. So it's really very encouraging to see that the next generation of scholars, our postgraduate students represented in this room and elsewhere, are taking very seriously this call to think beyond the traditional spaces and chronologies of European science. So the call to globalize the history of science also arose from a set of feelings, I guess, feelings about the map of the history of science. I guess there was a certain sense of frustration, on the one hand, about the prioritization of European materials and languages, and what that meant for the displacement of all kinds of other sorts of materials which are relevant to the making of science in the wider world. So that was one sort of location of frustration, one could say. Another was a frustration that if the wider world came in to the history of science, it usually came in relation to an expansionist narrative. What I mean by this is that historians of science were really quite concerned about, especially after 1500, the relationship between European imperialism and science. So it was a kind of question about empire and science, rather than what happens or what creates empire more broadly. Then, of course, and this picks up what the sort of historiographical survey that Owen provided us just now, histories of science adopted a diffusionist model on the one hand, and then a developmentalist model as well, tied to notions of centers and peripheries, or the kind of growing intellectual maturity, picking up some language that was in the literature in institutional terms, for instance, in the history of science. This is a sort of marker of the globalization of science. What this meant for scholars based in other parts of the world, say in India or parts of the Middle East, is that they in turn reacted against this European historiography of science by writing nationalist accounts of science for India or for the Middle East. And these two were based on equally shaky theoretical grounds. But I guess it's clear now in the last few years that there are some really very severe problems, nevertheless, with the current global turn in the history of the sciences. It's increasingly clear that we need to be aware of the sort of concept of the global, the concept history of the global, the way it picks up early modern imperialism, for instance, or early 20th century geography, or indeed post-colonial developmentalism. Global, and I had this before I listened to your paper, the version of the paper just now, global is not unimperial. Global as a term is tied up with empire too. In talking about global histories of science, there's also this danger, which has been highlighted in the paper we've just had, of locality disappearing, locality stopping to not matching very much, and a sort of very flattened idea of space. That wasn't the thing that we wanted to highlight in calling for a global history of science, but nevertheless, this word global can lead to this assumption of flattened space, which is very problematic. So given these gains and pitfalls, in the current global history of science, the task before this seminar, I guess, is to consider the alternative ways that lie ahead. In particular, I think it'll be important to consider questions of scale. The relationship between regional histories and world histories needs interrogation. So not imperial and national, but regional and world or global. Should there be a Latin American history of science? Or a Middle Eastern history of science, rather than a global history of science. Still on scale, what is the relationship between the individual traveller, broker, and intermediary, and their utilisation of science or their role in science, and the role of larger groups who connect up the world, merchants, missionaries, and such like? Another thought on scale, and this picks up a geographical and materialist reading, what is the relationship between land and sea, between rivers and seas, between plains and mountains in the history of the sciences? Historical geographers will no doubt play a very important role in addressing that particular aspect of scale. It will be also important to interrogate questions of epistemology or culture more broadly. Do we integrate the perspective of radically different sorts of narrations of natural knowledge, placed as they are in different ways against the textual, the ritual, or the institutional? Is there a danger of flattening out differences in bringing traditions together? These questions of integration would be very kind of vexed ones if we have to think across epistemological differences. So the seminar will, in this respect, need to come from very different vantage points. Coming from anthropology, it will need to ask about the embodied practices that underpin knowledge, their relationship to material objects, to systems of value and skill. Coming from HPS, and this picks up the paper we've had, the seminar may want to ask how or if recent approaches to artisanal or popular science, which have provided such rich insights, may or should be widened out in pluralizing the history of science across the world. Is there a reason to go from the artisanal to the indigenous, or is that a dangerous project? Coming from history, the seminar may want to ask about the politics or the economics of the transnational, not in the sense of the kind of global economic history of the world, but rather kind of transnational trade history or economic history. By this I mean forms of anti-colonialism or networks, diasporas of merchants and so on, which have been central to recent approaches in transnational history. Where does science lie in those kinds of networks? In addition to all of this, I have one final plea for the seminar, and that is to ask the question, what is the global history, or what is a global history for? And this picks up the comments made by our two visitors from South Africa and South Asia last term, who were particularly keen to work out the political and policy implications of global histories of science for the state that doesn't work in South Africa, or for the rise of a conservative Islamic take on the history of science, which benefits, perhaps, it was argued, from post-colonialism. Does the global history of science simply validate a sort of multiculturalism? Or does it instead intervene in some difficult problems facing our world by giving historical depth and insight? Now, that's just by way of general orientation. Now, let me just turn to the points that are raised by Owen's paper. So the image that Owen wants to dispense with is of the pointy arrow, this sort of grid of lines which link up the oceans, denoting in his case voyages to the Pacific, and this can of course be multiplied in many other sorts of maps and diagrams, maps of telegraph lines, maps of steamship routes, and so on. Instead of a flattened idea of space, which such maps give us, he wishes us to take account of the emotional investments made by humans in traversing the oceans, on the one hand. He makes this point in reminding us of ceremonies connected with crossing the line, for instance. Particular points or passages in voyages took on different meanings for those making them. So that's one sense in which that sort of idea of the pointy arrow needs to be complicated. He also wants us to complicate the role of instruments on board ships by remembering that instruments don't simply work in the same way everywhere. Instead, I don't know whether you use this word in this version, but it was in the previous version, there are pockets. Pockets of control and pockets where there's a lack of control, I take it. And the sort of keys and things like this come into that, perhaps. Another way in which these lines need to be plotted differently, he argues, comes from the relationships forged on board these vessels. Astronomers, cartographers, and officers did different kinds of labor or different kinds of work at various places. And the relationship between what they did on land and sea also needs to be put together, I take it, from his comments. So reading this paper made me start to wonder about what emphasizing the plural and contested contours of the ship voyage might add to the debates on the global histories of science. And the first question I wondered about was about the role of the indigenous, or what counts as the indigenous, or what is defined as the indigenous in all of this. So we've had a very rich literature on Pacific voyaging, which takes up the sort of role of Pacific navigators, assistants, and so on in the midst of Cook's voyages and following. So if we are to put the sea and the land together and bring in the indigenous, is there a symmetry across land and sea, or is there a difference? Is there a lot more intensity in dealing with the indigenous in relation to violence and friendship, etc., on land than there is on sea? Or can we actually sort of use the insights that have come out of this literature on Pacific indigenous relations more broadly in thinking across the land and sea divide, if one is to take your invitation on board? And related to this, and I return to the point I made earlier, is it useful to compare the sort of artisanal sort of dimensions with the indigenous dimensions? And my slight kind of concern with that lies in the fact that it's actually a period comparison, in the sense that the working classes are like sort of natives abroad, right, in the 19th century. And so is there a sort of danger of sort of adopting the sort of methodological kind of insights in the sort of history of artisanal histories of science, popular histories of science, etc., and sort of work them across without kind of, in a sense, destabilizing that very comparison that was made in the period that we're looking at. Thinking in another direction of this that is sort of opened up by this paper, if we pluralize the trajectory of the voyage, I wondered what that means for materialist readings of the ship voyage. And this actually picks up Drayton's work, for instance. Where do tides and currents, winds and waves, etc., come into this? So when we have had this call to think of a less flat sort of view of the seas, effectively, is it worth remembering the kind of materialist reading of the seas as well? So if those were questions related to Owen's invitation for us to pluralize and create more friction in the passage of these ships through these sort of circuits across the world, I also want to come to this topic from my own starting point in the Faculty of History. So if we are to take up the call for a global history of science, I would also like us to think across empires rather than simply thinking of the British case. So I just wonder, and Owen's published a really thought-provoking, wonderful essay, which I recommend to everyone, on Flinders, which is partly about Flinders' obsession with a cat and what that might tell us, but he could tell us more about that later, maybe at another occasion. Anyway, and a lot of his examples come from the same period of the late 18th century and the early 19th century, right? I mean, those are the examples, Bligh, et cetera, which are up on the screen. So Flinders was in a race, right? I mean, that's my reading. I'm not an expert on this, but Flinders was in a race, and it arose partly from Banks, the leading man of science in Britain in the early 19th century, having a second thought. Banks had arranged the passports for Baudin, the sort of French explorer, and then he sort of said, there's going to be a race. So he sort of sends off Flinders. So what's really interesting about that story, if my understanding of it is right, is that there is competition and collaboration right from the sort of onset of that expedition to chart Australia. So does it matter whether the voyage is French or British, especially given the context of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars? Flinders is imprisoned in Mauritius for 6 years. Baudin comes, at the same time, Baudin basically kind of touches in Australia. And as far as I understand, has a friendship with Flinders as well. So it seems really complicated in the sense that there are connections across the Anglo-French divide, even as there is a lot of sort of political friction and even imprisonment of Flinders on one side. So where does politics play into your story about timekeepers? And do these lines need to be thickened, and the word that you used just now was ruptured as well, in relation to political conflict too? It seems that some very interesting things are going on here in relation to science and politics on the global stage. And I'd like to know more about that too. So thank you very much for this paper, and thank you to those who've organized the seminar. And I wish it every success in the future.